This is Bentic, the Atari 8-bit podcast.
Hi, I'm Kevin Savitz, and this is an interview episode of Antic, the Atari 8-bit podcast. Ihor Wolosenko was co-founder of Synapse Software, the company that brought us Synfile and Syncalc and an amazing list of games, including Blue Max, Zeppelin, Ford Apocalypse, Alley Cat, Seamus, and Nautilus, and Rainbow Walker, and Protector 2, and even others. I interviewed Ihor on December 23rd, 2014, over Skype. Ihor sent me some scans of Synapse advertisement and box art and flyers and even a company Christmas card. I've uploaded all those to archive.org, and you'll find a link to that in the show notes at ataripodcast.com. Enjoy this interview with Ihor Wolosenko.
So how are you?
I am great. I'm fantastic. Thank you.
That's good.
How about you?
Oh, good, good. I've been reading up about myself. Since I have forgotten the past, and I thought it was important to sort of remember who I was then.
Did you learn any lurid details about yourself that disgusted you?
I did. Well, not so much that disgusted me, although I anticipated that. But you know, it was the hype was quite impressive. That's all I can say. So how is it that you bring? Well, you're going to do the interview. Well, I'm sorry, but I was just interested in why you have this interest in sort of revivifying the past and creating this chronicle.
I don't think I never kind of fell out of love with the Atari 8-bit computers. It's not like, oh, this is thing from my past, and oh, isn't this interesting again? It literally, I've like always had one.
Yeah.
And
you still have one?
I've got three on the desk behind me.
800s with 64?
I have an 800, an 800XL, uh-huh. And I think there's an Atari 400 around somewhere too.
I think the XL went up to 128, didn't it?
Yes, the XE.
Massive memory capacity.
Right, yeah. You're never going to need that much memory. Never. Yeah. So it's me and a couple of the guys do this podcast, and it's kind of like an online monthly computer retro computing meeting. We just talk about what we've been doing, and then my kind of favorite part is doing these interviews where I find people from back in the day and get their take on what it was like to be there in the trenches, you know, making software or developing operating systems or whatever it was.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I can see that. Yeah.
First of all, pronounce your name for me so I do it right.
Sure. Ihor Wolosenko. Mm-hmm.
Wolosenko. Okay. All right. And you were co-founder of Synapse Software.
That's correct.
Okay. Tell me how that happened. How do you go from not owning a software publishing company to having a publishing company?
Well, you know, it was as in most things, it's a matter of being in the right place at the right time and having a particular need that that isn't being satisfied. Or multi dimensions of needs that aren't being satisfied. That was the time when CoinOp was ascendant, you know, and Atari CoinOp was the big gorilla. The graphics that were possible on those dedicated machines were so much better than what was possible on the Apple and especially on the Apple and some of the earlier systems even than that. You know, I mean, certainly the PET and the other early computers didn't have anything. They, you know, hooked up to TVs with 40 line scans and all that kind of stuff. You know, everything going through NTSC and anyway, so. One of the things was I was really into going out and pumping lots of quarters into Galaxian and earlier things than that, and so So there was a, I think it probably, you know, if you look at it a bit more fundamentally, it's kind of a real hunger for interactivity. You know, it's the first time that we were able to, and I think, you know, the real compelling part of video games was that there was something all of a sudden that was interactive and challenging, surprising, all of those kinds of things, both, you know, both in the text world with, you know, with Adventure and Zork. And I mean, the first time I remember that I sat down to play Adventure, to have something that, you know, had a parser and could, depending on what you were doing, what you wanted to do, you know, send you into an imaginary realm and be interactive was really great. The other thing was that at that time I was doing a lot of hypnosis and hypnosis, sort of hosting hypnosis workshops and neuro-linguistic programming, all this kind of stuff that I was into. And I needed something that would that I could use for a database and be able to keep in contact with people, have a mailing list, announcements, that kind of stuff. So the convergence of those two kinds of things, you know, were what sort of got me interested. You know, it's funny, before that, I used to be a photographer back in the day in Boston. You know, I had a big commercial studio and I did a lot of work for Deck and Digital and all that kind of stuff. And it's interesting because they, for me, computers, you know, minis, particularly at that point, were just objects to be photographed. And I remember that when I came to Berkeley and, you know, started discovering what computers were capable of, it was interesting. A third sort of thread that ran through that was I was interested in Tibetan Buddhism and, you know, was studying that at the time. And I was interested in how the traditions from other cultures are able to be transmitted into cultures that don't have the same sort of the same kinds of expectations. So, for example, if you know, I don't know if you speak any other languages, but in order to really be a native speaker and speak well, you have to assimilate not only the words that of the other language, but all of the attitudes, the emotional connotations, the discriminations in the particular things that those languages specialize in because of whatever their historical background was. So I thought the computer was a way of formally modeling languages and extracting the active elements from how languages worked, kind of Chomsky-like kinds of things. What were, you know, what the assumptions were, how the syntax of the languages worked. And so how do you take that Tibetan particular kind of understanding and assimilate it through a language that doesn't have the correct environment for it to be understood, that it's automatically a translation into the things you're familiar with. So anyway, so I thought computer languages would be a good way of doing it. So those were the sort of three threads that brought me to computers.
Okay.
A long-winded kind of thing. Sorry about that. But
So how do you get from Tibetan stuff and neuro-linguistic programming to Seamus and Protector 2?
Well, it's, you step up to what's necessary. Mm-hmm. The first thing was file manager. Right, so that was the first thing that Synapse did, and seeing how successful that was because of the hunger that was out there for software to run on the new toys that were being produced.
So SynFile, was that what we're talking about at this point?
Actually, it was called File Manager before it was SynFile. Right,
okay.
It was the first iteration. Seeing how that was enthusiastically embraced. And
so that was something that it seems like you created as a tool for yourself because you
that's
for your mailing
Ken,
lessons.
Ken and I, yeah, created mm-hmm. that initially, and then, you know, we had enough sense to understand that a company really couldn't work on the basis of a single product, that that would burn through rather quickly. So I had been a member of the Atari users group in San Francisco, and had met you know several people, my partner, Ken, and I met another programmer called Rob Ray, and he had a game called Dodge Racer that he had been developing, and so I began to approach some other people in kind of inventing what it meant to be a publisher in that kind of early phase. I was making contacts on the basis of file managers, people who wanted product. Mm-hmm. And then Mike Potter, I met him, and he had written the, what was ultimately Protector. And he was working with Crystalware, and he wasn't happy, et cetera, et cetera. And so anyway, so kind of redesigned that a little bit. Worked on Dodge Racer with Ray, and then, you know, then the snowball started growing, the slope of the mountain increased precipitously. So there were many many different products. I just had game, you know, I enjoyed games, so I had ideas for what kind of game action I would like to see, what kind of challenges I would like to see. I had, you know, particularly. They were just dynamic puzzles that interested me. So started designing other games, you know, Chicken and I forgot what else was in that early batch. I think Nautilus, and you know, certainly inspired by many of the things that I saw around me in CoinOp, mm-hmm. And thought were interesting exercises, and you know, and ultimately. Thinking about what it was about the games that was so compelling. I mean, what was the addictive quality? You know, was that something that was interesting, or that you could exploit, or that it was ultimately satisfying? You know, interested in the reactions. I mean, you know, so much of the time when you finished playing, you know, these very sort of jerky games, you know, the feeling wasn't one of calm and boy, that was a great time. It was like, boy, this I'm really frustrated now, you know, and especially in games that were, you know, very kind of repetitive in the sense that you had to go through the same environment. You know, Prince mm-hmm. of Persia comes to mind as one of those kinds of things that you have to get this whole ritual of actions that have to be repeated precisely in order to get to the next level, et cetera, et cetera. Mm-hmm. Anyway, here we go again.
So did you do programming at all, or were you like the idea guy and business person and other people did the programming?
I did programming as well. I mean, file manager, for example, I did the look of it, the structure of structure in terms of what functionality offered. I did some assembler programming for, you know, sorts and this kind of stuff. But it was fascinating, but it wasn't my first love.
Right.
The first love was, you know, much more of a creative kind of thing of how and why people do what they do. I mean, so this is just the one little subset of things to explore of how and why people do things, in the same way that Tibetan Buddhism is, or that hypnosis is, or, you know, whatever kinds of things. You know, what makes people tick and why, and how can those itches be scratched?
So why did you launch first with, it seems like mostly you started off with really strong with the Atari stuff, and then later on you did Commodore and things. But why the Atari?
I think the Atari was probably the most interesting machine at the time. And Atari's, the hubris that Atari brought to it, unfortunately, didn't allow the Atari to really reach the ascendant place that I think that it should have had. You know, their mistake of not having it as an open system the way that Apple did was, you know, Atari would be where Apple was. I mean, aside from obviously the characters and, you know, some of the other kind of things, but you know, they had Joe DeCuir, you know, design some really great chips for it. It had, you know, separate graphics, separate sound. It had a lot of wonderful things that Apple didn't do on top of the 6502. But because they closed up the system and they wanted to absolutely wring every last penny out of it and control everything as the, you know, in the way that Apple did ultimately. Mm-hmm. But I'm sure that's one of the lessons that Jobs secreted away from his time at Atari, in wanting to have a closed system and to control all of the stuff. And I think it was just a very, very silly way to go. But it offered the most. I mean, when I looked at the kinds of games that were on Atari and the things that those chips enabled, you know, it was clearly more interesting. Commodore, of course, is, you know, a generation later with the 64. But at the time that the Atari 400, 800 was out, really Apple and I forgot what there was another one, Exodus. At any rate, there was another computer that was out around the same time. But none of them really offered those kinds of features.
So when you start coming out with cartridges, I'm wondering about the technical aspect of, you were one of the relatively early companies to create cartridges. Did you do that in-house? Did you find someone else to do that?
Yeah, we found someone else who was specifically looking at the cartridge business as their business model. And so they came to us, and cartridges were extremely, extremely expensive to produce. So there was this guy who was, he was sort of semi-sleazy. At any rate, the cartridges that were produced were very expensive to produce. You had to commit to large numbers for them to have make any kind of sense. But they bridged that, you know, the convenience of the 2600 into the 400, 800 in terms of having cartridge. And also you had an additional ROM space. But, you know, the cartridges were tiny, and trying to squeeze all the stuff into it. The cartridge games initially were much simpler than the other media. I mean, we were loading from tape, you know, which was absurd, of course. And, right, you know, and the discs that were sort of interesting. The discs, well, at any rate, that's another story. Yeah.
No, I want to know all the stories. Tell me the disc story.
Right. Well, the discs, you know, one of the things was of course, you know, how do you protect your stuff, right?
Right.
So I remember in the first, with the file manager, since it retailed at that time for about $100. So protection was very important. So what I did is I got one of these, one of the disc drives, an old disc drive, and I taped on a nail to where the write read head was, and suspended that in a particular space, you know, disconnected the stepper on it, and so that it scratched out a little groove in the magnetic coating on the discs, and then we referenced that in the protection, that it had to find nothing there in order for it to boot. And then at the same time...
So you physically damaged a sector or a track on the disc.
Exactly, yeah. Just scraped it with a blunt nail.
So did you have one drive?
One drive.
That only did that, and then...
Absolutely. That was constantly preparing the discs. And at the same time, I developed a little plug-in for one of the game stick ports. And so I didn't know a whole lot about digital electronics, so I went out and I bought a Radio Shack Introduction to Digital Electronics kit, and you know, did a lot of reading, and then developed one little IC package that you know, when the input was on 1 and 3, you know, 2 and 4 were active, whatever, you know, whatever the matrix was, Then I developed a little little printed circuit that fit into, and then went to the local college in Oakland that had a an injection press in one of its plastics courses, and so I contracted with them to take these. So I had the little I had the printed circuits made, and I would cut up those printed circuit boards on my radial arm saw, right, into tiny little bits, stuff it with chips. I had a student from UC who was soldering this stuff. Then I'd take this to the shop in a bin, and I would have the students at the course plastic, you know, it had this little connector that was in there, and the entire thing would then be put into a little plastic package on an injection, on a hand injection machine. And these were the little data lock keys. So that was the protection. It was the data lock key, and it was the scraped track.
So the data lock key would plug into a joystick port,
right,
or something?
Into one of the joystick ports, right.
Kind of a dongle to...
Right. It was the first dongle.
Interesting.
Yeah. So anyway, so that was how the discs worked. But back to the ROMs. So the ROMs were difficult to anticipate what the numbers were, and ultimately they were money losing because the base of the computers was not growing quickly enough, and the types of games that could be put on them at a reasonable cost were quickly being stripped by more complex games requiring greater memory.
So you talked about, you're worried about people copying software, and that's one of the things I wanted to ask you about was piracy, not just on that early software, but all along. Was that a problem that you thought about a lot, and how did you...
Interestingly enough, I mean, in the very beginning, when you've put, you know, an infinity of hours into developing something, and, you know, and all-nighters all the time to try to get this stuff going and debugged and all the documentation, all that stuff, every hour you want to regain, you know, and you want to be compensated for. So at first it's like, hey, you know, if we give away any of these things, it's like we're giving away our blood that we put into it. But after a while, after you've sold a couple of thousand of them, you become more sanguine about the entire thing, right? And it's like, you know, as far as I was concerned, the people who are going to buy it, we're going to buy it. The people who are going to steal it, we're going to steal it. And to the extent that those who stole it liked what they saw, they would buy the next stuff. Or maybe they would buy the next stuff. Let's say a small percentage would still be ahead of the game. If a lot of people stole it, yeah, so be it. And, you know, and I think that sort of laissez-faire attitude, despite the, you know, the very public protestations, or the way that a lot of companies still feel about it, you know, I mean, AutoCAD, for example, you know, or SolidWorks, or, you know, any of these extremely expensive programs that a hobbyist would never spend money for, you know, the kind of money that's necessary. You know, so somebody who's using AutoCAD, whether it's a pirated version, or when they get a job, if they get a job in what they'd like to do, they're going to be familiar with that software. So it's an automatic sale, you know, an automatic perpetuation of that particular, you know, hegemony that they have established over what they're doing. So in a way, having a closed system where nobody can switch out of your hardware, and piracy sort of, you know, accomplish the same kind of thing, which is to spread out and to infiltrate and suppress other kinds of software. I mean, if you have something that's fully functioning, that you've pirated, you've learned how to use it, you go and you're not going to really try a lot of the less developed technologies.
Right.
And so, you know, and yet the people who make it can say, oh, you know, this is a horrible thing and all these people are stealing. Meanwhile, nobody's going to bed hungry at Autodesk.
Right. I can see how that kind of philosophy can work well for AutoCAD or for SYN file or something, but maybe not so much for a game where you're just going to play it and forget it.
Well, it depends. I mean, if it introduces you to a company, or if it introduces you to a designer that you really like, then you're going to try to get the next. And maybe at that point you'll say, hey, man, that guy really spent a lot of time on that, and I'd like to do that. I mean, there are certainly hundreds of programs that I have bought that I have wanted to grab people by the neck and say, I want my money back. This is a piece of shit. You know? And there have been, you know, many programs that I've bought where I say, wow, this guy really deserves every penny that he makes. Same thing with literature, you know.
Sure, absolutely, anything.
So in a sense, you know, you're in the powerless position, right? One is always cast as the consumer, right? Not as, you know, when the news talks about all of the consumers, not all of the citizens, not all of the, you know, this, whatever it is, you know, consumer is this sort of this lowliest SKU of who you are.
Right.
That's what you exist for. That's your functionality. And so, you know, so that kind of, you know, disproportionate power kind of, you know, of the company to the consumer is something that I think people feel piracy in a way addresses. It's indirect because it may not be against the company that you would like to punish for the crap that they've delivered to you, but it's a way of gaining some power back from everything that's pushed onto you.
What was Synapse's biggest... I have two separate but related questions. What was Synapse's biggest success financially, and what was its biggest success in your mind, not necessarily financially?
Financially. I don't think that there was a single product that was head and shoulders, but there were certainly more popular products. You know, certainly the whole SYN file and that was a popular thing. You know, Seamus was popular. Necromancer was popular. Alley Cat. All of them were really. I mean, there were some that didn't really shine, but typically we had a pretty good response to most of the stuff that was out there, and it was a large variety of games. I think, you know, one of the most interesting projects was what ultimately we couldn't really follow through with, and that was the electronic novel, you know, kind of cycle that I thought was challenging and interesting from a lot of different perspectives. You know, how do you create a game that, you know, doesn't interfere with the suspension of disbelief? You know, what kind of structure do you develop for something that doesn't have a narrative arc that's very specific? What kind of people are the most appropriate to develop that kind of a world, you know? And working with the various people and, you know, with poets and playwrights and novelist inspired kinds of things was interesting. You know, it was interesting in the kinds of challenges that the parser needed to address in order to make the game seamless. You know, how all of that kind of stuff, you know, in terms of immersion, I mean, how do you create a parallel experience to the immersion of a movie or the immersion of a play? And and I think that it's still at a very primitive level, in that, you know, Twitch and the kind of, you know, if you have a palette of all you can create in people really is frustration, anger, and those kinds of things, I don't think you've really been successful in exploring the entire, you know, experiential continuum that we're capable of, you know?
Right.
So, and when I see that, you know, when I see a first-person shooter, that's one kind of thing. You know, RTS is interesting in another way because it does have, you know, more sort of, you know, not only tactical, but you know, longer range kinds of things, puzzle games or something else. But the complete experience of of merging into a character and then, you know, engaging the world through the eyes of that character, being changed by the world, all that kind of stuff, simply I haven't really seen. I mean, is it something that, am I wrong? Are there things that, are there dimensions of love, caring, compassion, all of these kinds of things that might, that, that you felt out of your game playing?
Not in games of old. I mean, I don't play a lot of modern games,
right,
personally, but I mean, I understand that you know, this, some of the story arcs in some of the big blockbuster games are, you know, the kind of things that make people, can make people really care about the characters. And, you know, you remind me of that old, there was an old ad for, maybe it was Electronic Arts. It was like, can a computer make you cry?
No, that was,
remember that ad?
That was ours.
Was it?
Yes.
Oh, I, that was an excellent ad because I remembered it, but just not that it was for you guys. I'm sorry. Wow.
That's quite all right.
Well, yeah, that's okay. Well, that's what you reminded me of, I guess.
Yeah, so that's right. So, you know, my greatest success or Synapse's greatest success was that, you know, one of the reasons that Synapse, you know, went the way of the dodo is really because of Atari's, I mean, specifically because of Atari and you know, the trivialized Atari and all of the money that I owed us, that they owed us, and you know, all of that kind of stuff. But I think ultimately that, you know, when we stopped was the ascent of Nintendo and Sega and all the rest of the stuff. And you know, people just went to those machines that had better graphics. They were, I mean, they were basically coin-op games that were then available, you know, you know, not only that, but coin-op plus that were available to people, which, you know, NTSC connections to TVs just weren't able to deliver. And so, yeah.
All right, so since you mentioned it, let's jump to the end. The kind of lore, at least what Wikipedia says, is that Jack Tramiel took over at Atari and he refused to pay for some 40,000 units of software that you had already shipped, and that kind of led to the beginning of the end.
That's correct. That's exactly what happened. And, you know, Ken went in, you know, it was the transfer of ownership was going on while we were delivering the last of the, it was a SIN file, I think. there was a spreadsheet program. There was a stock market program. Anyway, so we developed all these units. We packaged them. I mean, we did all of the packaging on them. We delivered them as completed products to them. So, mm-hmm. You know, 40,000 units of this stuff, or however many there were. So it was significant dollars. It was I don't know, $1.5 million, something like that, of product that they didn't pay us for, but we had all the expenses out for already. You know, since we hadn't had to pay our vendors for all of that stuff. So, you know, Ken went in and he talked to the Sam Tramiel, mm-hmm. Jack Tramiel's son, and mm-hmm. and you know, and he said something like, he took the contract and he showed it to Ken. He said, you know, I've always wanted to do this. And he rips up the contract in front of him. He says, this contract isn't worth the paper it's printed on. And you know, so Ken was somewhat surprised and disappointed in the reaction. But he said, you know, you guys, you know, I deal with companies like you every time. You know, I do this to everybody. So, you know, don't feel like it's about you. And for 10 companies, every 10 companies I do this for, one has the resources to come after me. Mm-hmm. So good luck.
He's just an all-around a-hole. It wasn't specific to
him. No, I mean, so, you know, there was a feeling of, you know, of being inclusive, which was very nice and warm. that we were part of a larger population of people.
Right.
Anyway, so, you know, hey, he got, you know, I mean, Tramiel was, you know, his whole history was in basically taking companies and, you know, kind of squeezing them for whatever they could. More than he could.
So that happened, and then how did Broderbund come a calling, or did you go to them?
Oh well, you know, we had been actually talking to Broderbund in that year about doing some kind of merger. You know, I was really good friends and still am with Gary Carlston and Doug, and so we'd been talking about it, and you know, they thought that the Atari market was certainly not going to increase very much. Apple was what they really made their money on, obviously. Mm-hmm. But they thought that we had a good resource of programmers because we did, you know, most of our stuff internally. They liked the electronic novels. And, you know, so basically they got the company for virtually nothing. You know, the only thing that we retained out of that was our suit against Atari.
Lucky you.
Well, I mean, that was part of me. We had spent that money, you know, and yeah. And so, and ultimately we prevailed in that and we were paid. Hmm. You know, this was after much, much foot dragging. And I mean, perhaps someday I'll describe to you the depositions and the other nonsense that we went through in order to get it. So, you know, so it was going and going and going, and they weren't going to pay us and they weren't going to pay us. And then 2 days before the trial, lo and behold, a settlement. Hmm. You know, because the depositions, I mean, their depositions clearly showed, you know, that the stuff was taken and never paid for.
Right. So you sold the company for a song, but ultimately you got paid what you're owed from Atari.
Right.
And that must have been some consolation then.
Well, it certainly was, you know, but it wasn't like we sold the company. I mean, the company really wasn't worth anything at that point. I mean, we wanted to keep the programmers working, and we wanted to keep the you know, the structure of Synapse for the people who were there viable, so that it wasn't shut down. People didn't lose their jobs, and Broderbund felt like they could capitalize on what we had produced, and you know, and they had better distribution in a lot of ways, and you know, this was text adventures were still a possibility at that time. Mm-hmm.
Were your programmers freelancer, like royalty paid freelancers, or were they employees?
Oh, a combination of both. For the people who were working in-house, for the most part, we had draws against royalties so that, you know, they could survive and live. And I mean, you know, the games typically required, you know, one or two or three people, certainly in the very beginning. You know, it got into a bit larger teams towards the end. But, you know, one or two or three, you know, somebody to do the coding, somebody to do the music, somebody to do, you know, whatever other kinds of interfacing with other things like, you know, protection or this or that, whatever it was. So the budgets really were, what does it take to keep somebody alive? Mm-hmm. And, you know, with the hope payoff. And we, you know, our royalty structure was pretty good, you know, probably more than most companies. I think it was in the range of 10 to 20% or something like that, you know. And then we had, actually it was higher for some, but anyway, and then we just paid for the time that they were there, and, you know, and I had very close relationships with lots of people, so you know, whatever they needed, I was more than happy to provide it, because I really felt like they were doing stuff that they really loved, and you know, it was benefiting me. It certainly should benefit them, and the camaraderie was, you know, it was inventing it all the time, and you know, very very dynamic, very interesting. Kind of dedication that was there. So there were, you know, so the programmers were over sort of in one wing, and then, you know, the marketing and sales and kind of stuff were another wing, and then production. You know, we did all of our own production, mm-hmm. Which was the major area. I think about, I don't know, 15,000 square feet or something like that. You know, of boxes and this and that.
And where was all this?
This was in Berkeley. Okay. Or actually, yeah, right on the border of Berkeley. Yeah. in Richmond. Where are you calling from, incidentally? Where are you?
Portland, Oregon.
Oh, yeah. Okay, cool.
And where are you now?
I'm in Victoria, in BC.
Okay.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And yeah, I moved up here about 10 years ago from Northern California. I was in Sebastopol for a while.
Okay. You know,
yeah, all over. I've really lived in a lot of different places, done a lot of different things.
That's interesting. What made you leave? Why'd you leave the U.S.?
Bush.
Okay.
You know, short story. Didn't like the politics. Was able to do it. I was either going to go to New Zealand. I really like New Zealand. Mm-hmm. I've been there a few times. But decided, came up here with a woman I had just met for a little vacation to Victoria. Mm-hmm. And said, hey, this is pretty nice. And like the Canadian vibe a lot more. I like the difference in density. I mean, even though I lived, you know, in Sebastopol, which is about an hour north of San Francisco, you know, the density of 101 and the density of everything that was in California, it was just, I prefer more rural kinds of things. You know, I've got a lot of different things that I do that, you know, are sort of solitary activities. And I like the quiet. You know, one of the most important things for me in where I live is just how quiet it is.
So what do you do now?
Well, I'm doing a lot of songwriting and singing and that kind of stuff. I build guitars, acoustic guitars and stuff like that. No, really, keep really active in terms of just all kinds of interests. I like CNC stuff and doing, you know, lots of CNC sculptural kinds of things as well. I got two dogs that I really enjoy spending time with, and my wife. Just have a pretty nice, you know, I have a pretty nice place up here that's away from town and about 20 minutes into Victoria. And so,
awesome.
Yeah, I've been just, you know, I've been super lucky in my life in terms of pursuing in all of the different careers that I've had and different things that I've done becoming interested in something, you know, becoming, you know, sort of passably conversant in it, you know, and being able or being certainly in the situation of Atari and computers, it was an unplowed field, you know, so it was fun making it up and fun sort of directing how it went to, and there was this insatiable kind of an appetite for interactivity of any kind. In other things that I've done, it's just right place at the right time, becoming, you know, good enough that people were interested in what you were doing. And so I've been able to follow my interests my entire life.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Do you still have an Atari?
No, I don't think I do anymore, no.
Do you have anything from the Synapse days?
I don't know. I have much memorabilia from the Synapse days. And in fact, you know, I'm trying to remember. There, I was in contact with a guy last year. I scanned a lot of game boxes and catalogs, and you know, original kind of memorabilia, and sent those to them. I have those scans. If you might be interested in them,
I would absolutely be interested.
Yeah,
yeah. And if you have any, part of what I do besides the interviews is I try to find material that maybe hasn't been available in the world before. Source code, design documents, you know, anything like that. I'm going to show you something that is relevant to you. I interviewed Gray Chang.
Sure, I remember Gray.
Not too long ago.
Yeah, Plane Jumper. Yes.
Yeah. This is the notebook where he built, I mean, this is the notebook where he took all the notes for creating ClaimJumper.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
It's filled with flowcharts and code and just, you know, graphics that he did in graph paper, just like, you know, 100 pages of it.
Right.
And he lent it to me, and I scanned the whole thing. Mm-hmm. 600 DPI, and it's going up on archive.org. So if anyone who cares about Atari wants to like find out how this game was designed from front to back, top to bottom, it's here.
Fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and I've got to mention, you know, that, you know, all of the guys that I worked with were, you know, super talented. You know, Steve Hales is just, you know, he's just such a sweetheart of a guy, and, you know, very talented. And right from the very beginning, when Mike Potter introduced me to him, you know, we had a really nice rapport. I mean, all of the guys, you know, Steve Coleman and his brother, you know, he did, he did Pharaoh's Curse and Rainbow Walker, and, you know, all of these kinds. He was really interesting. And he, you know, and different people had the ability to, needed different kinds of input in terms of, you know, just the game concept or you know, going through it very, very specifically for, you know, every single action. And it really depended on the personality and, you know, and how they were going to execute on their own vision, or whether they needed a lot of help with it, or whether it was my vision. I really, you know, felt like I didn't really want it to go in a different place or whatever it was. But I mean, there were extremely talented people, you know, a lot of people from UC Berkeley. Russ, you know, who did Picnic Paranoia, was really incredible. You know, William / Catherine Mataga, incredible genius of a programmer. I mean, really just amazing. I mean, I could just go on and on. There were particular people that I developed personal relationships with that were more, you know, that were deeper than others. But I was just really impressed by the involvement and the dedication of all these people in what they were true artists, you know, in a as yet unexplored medium.
If you could send a message to the Atari users who still exist. And you can right
Christmas.
Now. What?
Merry Christmas!
Right. Excellent. Great. They're not going to hear this until like February. So.
Merry next Christmas and happy holidays. Yes. And happy Valentine's Day as well. Yes. No, if I could send a yes, what would it be? You know, interestingly enough, here's something. You know, I started another software company years later, and that's a subject for another kind of thing. But I had one of my offices for that new company in Kiev. I'm Ukrainian, mm-hmm. and I speak Ukrainian, you know, so I was able to travel back and forth. And I had about 15 programmers working on different stuff there. And it was really interesting in encountering these programmers, how many of them had played Synapse games and how familiar they were with all of the different games and how much they had really loved them. It's really, you know, I mean, as you grow older, you know, and you have these reverberations from things that you don't really remember very much, or things that have a particular, you know, spot in your memory of, you know, what you did and why you did it and what the repercussions of those were. All of a sudden, there are these reverberations that come from very unexpected sources on how mm-hmm. you might have inspired them or moved them or, you know, or brought pleasure or whatever it was through the kinds of things that you were involved in. And so, you know, in, I would say probably at least half the programmers that I ultimately worked with on these other projects knew all about Synapse and all the games and, you know, and how wonderful they were, et cetera, et cetera. So it's, you know, you never know where those kinds of effects are going to come from those, you know, from those little originating causes, you know, and they're not proximal typically. They're just really all over the place. Mm-hmm. So the message is, I don't know, thanks. Thanks for all the fish. I mean, I don't know. It's, you know, it was an interesting time, and certainly in the same way that, you know, that particular tunes dominate your life, and you sort of look at your progression through life, you know, with the kinds of music that you listen to and the artists and, you know, what they, the kind of angst that they spoke to at that particular developmental stage in your life. Same thing with the games. I mean, they are very specific in the kinds of memories that they encode and the kinds of times that they encode, both good and bad. But you know, not only do you think about the games, but you think about the excitement of that time. You think about, you know, how old you were, your friends at that time, you know, how they affected you, what kinds of doors they opened for you or closed or whatever it was. And so I think that that kind of cultural encoding and being able to be part of that in some small way is really neat.
Good answer.
Thank you.
Is there anything I should have asked you that I haven't?
No, you know what? I mean, we can certainly follow this up. You know, I'll send you a lot of stuff that I have. And if you'd like to, and by that time, hopefully, I'll have my video back. I'll be happy to get into anything that either you or the people who ultimately, you know, participate in this kind of thing might want to know. Because, I mean, those are you know, the questions that I want to answer aren't necessarily the questions that people want to ask. And so I'd be more than happy to do that. And if it triggers, you know, some kind of an association in the way that we talked about the protection or the Tremeils or, you know, whatever, I'd be happy to share that. I mean, it's difficult to get the excitement and the intimacy of that particular period embodied in such a way that you know, people can track it. I mean, they're going to track it through their own experience and, you know, and how those games came out and what they were looking forward to, and you know, there was the competitive element, you know, Crystal Arts, you know, Atari itself, all of this kind of stuff, you know, coin op, being frustrated by the limitations of the machine, being forced into memory constraints that were tiny, and, you know, working against those all the time, working with the personalities, of the people, all very interesting stuff, and just yeah, it's funny, you know, because I'm not a person who generally lives in the past. And when you ask me these questions, I sort of revivify that experience again. It's a good place to go to, yeah. If there's more that you'd like, I'd be happy to help.
Great, thank you. Well, I think that's about it for now. But I could be back. You never know.
Right then, and I'll send you as much stuff as I can find. So be expecting a deluge of
great. And I will assume anything you send, I can share, unless
absolutely.
You say it's private or something.
Absolutely.
All right.
And in fact, I have some physical objects that probably I won't be needing. Maybe I can share those for some kind of, I don't know if there's some kind of a museum of stuff, but when we launched Blue Max, for example, Bob Poland, another very, very interesting character, Stanford guy, who was also, he wrote Blue Max, and so that was a sort of our takeoff on Zaxxon. We actually did Zaxxon conversions later, but
oh, I was going to ask you about that. But okay,
yeah.
We'll get
so,
that
so
in a
yeah. So Poland was really an interesting character. He was a very funny Asian guy, and he was part of a team that went to Vegas for card counting. And did a lot of that stuff that the original MIT team did as well, and mm-hmm. and was thrown out of every casino when he was on the books. So we would go to CES, we would go around with him, and, you know, and it was funny, he would wear wigs and disguises and, you know, would pretend to be drunk and all of this kind of stuff. But he was just a really, really interesting character. I spent a lot of fun time with him doing things. Kelly Jones, you know, really interesting guy. He's still a very good friend of mine. And we did Drelbs together, and that was a lot of fun. And then he became the director of programming and sort of, you know, kind of herding these cats as much as he could in a rooms and back, and also an interesting guy. You know, he had gone to Santa Cruz had similar kind of past background to my own checkered past, and so that was fun. Anyway, so there I go, off to memory lane again. So you were saying about Zaxxon or
yeah. First of all, if you can.
Oh yes. Yeah, so, I lost the point. I'm sorry. Let me just finish that thought. So when we launched BlueMax, we hired an aerobatics pilot and a plane in I think it was in Sonoma County, and we brought the press up there, and so we had this aerobatics pilot in a open cockpit biplane fly over and drop socks full of a flour onto targets, and everybody got to go up and stuff like that. And I have one of these scarves from that event, you know. So it was anyway. So I have some of this kind of memorabilia and trivia, and you know, if you can suggest maybe a place that might enjoy it, I'm not one that that really holds on to these things. And
sure, there's a couple of computer museums that I'm sure would love that stuff. I can help you find them.
Sure. So you were saying.
So yeah, BlueMax is a great game, and I didn't honestly never thought that it was your take on Zaxxon. Although now that you've said it, I see.
Well, it was a scroller, you know. It was right. Know, 2.5 pieces.
With kind of that isometric
scroller, yeah. And I thought it was a more, you know, I mean, it wasn't coin-op, so there was more stuff you could develop into it, you know.
Right. So you guys developed the Commodore version of Zaxxon.
That's right.
But the Atari version was done by Datasoft.
That's right.
And I was wondering if there's any what drama on that was.
No, I was in really good terms with the guy from Datasoft. I think his name was Pat Ketchum. He was from LA, and he was much more of a business type, and he was looking at, and so he was good at getting lots of licensing, because he wasn't into developing original games. He thought that the license model was the way to go in order to maximize his company. And so I think that I don't remember exactly how it happened that it fell out that way, but I think we were talking to the same people at the same time, and he wasn't doing C64 development, and we agreed to do it. And we were another very funny thing. I remember IBM coming to us, and we did several games for IBM adaptations, you know, into for the original PC, which was, you know, pretty absurd. It was 80 line green screen. But the kinds of demands that they had of all the games for IBM, there would be a separate room with cages around it, and that, you know, nobody who was working on another game would be allowed to work on the IBM games, and security and all, you know, a certain type of security on the doors. And of course, we agreed to everything and did nothing, you know. And they got their, you know, and they got their games. But I mean, it was, you know, it was crazy. I mean, and they, you know, talk about the sort of that, you know, 1980s, early 1980s suits coming in and negotiating, you know, the power negotiating team from IBM arriving at our place. I mean, it was the height of you know, incongruity.
I'm imagining them in their white long sleeve shirts and their ties.
Oh, absolutely. And of course, you know,
and you guys are a bunch of Berkeley hippies.
Yeah,
right?
we're sitting around, you know, and we, you know, we'd like to see your programming department, you know, and they come over there, and the front part of it is filled with coin-op machines, right? So we've got like 6 coin-op machines up against the wall because everybody likes to play them. A couple of couches where people sleep, you know, and a warren of, you know, of different computers laid out all over the place, you know, with people, you know, either talking in teams or working on it, or, you know, some people, you know, in this sort of cloud of concentration. But, you know, so it was quite different. So they, you know, they were not expecting this, and they thought that perhaps we should take them a bit more seriously. I thought otherwise. But anyway, That was kind of interesting. And so you kind of get these glimpses into how other people approach it. So Pat approached it one way, IBM approached it another way. You know, I'd say Crystalware was probably closer to our approach. Atari itself was a very strange place. As I said earlier, it was just a strange place in the sense that of this hubris that I had described earlier. You know, it was, they were very quickly, very quickly expanding. They had developed into this gorilla that was dictating everything to everybody. And originally, we thought we would sell File Manager to them, and you know that they would produce it and stuff. And you know, and it was ridiculous trying to negotiate with them. I think originally our I don't know whether it was Fred Thorlin or somebody in Atari who was in charge of their acquisitions, but the kind of scorn that they visited upon people who would come as supplicants to the great temple of Atari was personally infuriating. And and after we did that, and and we said, hey, these people have their head up their ass, we're not going to give it to them. And so we said, okay, we're just going to do our own company, and that's going to be the end of it. And so, in a sense, I thank that hubris for launching Synapse initially. But, everything about it. I had friends who were in production. Jerry, I forgot his last name, who was the head of production over at Atari. And some other people that I knew there that I thought were decent people. But it was one of these kinds of things. Their success went to their head, and they just never treated people as having. I mean, it was for them, and the background they had come out of, it was a zero sum game, and everybody else was going to get zero, as far as they were concerned, and the sort of. The gestures that they made towards the acquisition program, and I know Gray came out of that API. I mean, and so did I'm trying to remember.
Caverns of Mars.
No, I'm just trying to remember the name of the programmer, and he was such a sweet guy. Unfortunately, he died a few years ago. He did Neuromancer and Alley Cat. Mm-hmm. And he was absolutely brilliant. I can't believe that I forgot.
Yeah, who programmed Alley Cat? Yeah, I saw he died maybe a year ago.
Right, and he was the sweetest guy and the most creative programmer I've ever worked with. And
Bill Williams,
right. And I spent a lot of time with him. He was also interested in all kinds of other things. He had built a geodesic dome back then for himself, and he had some affliction. It was multiple sclerosis, I think, in that he had to have massages all the time every morning to clear his lungs, and his wife was sort of this angel of mercy. I mean, very, very nice woman, and he was wonderful. He was very young, but he had a great imagination and fantastic, fantastic programming skills. He really took the machine to places that were revelations. Anyway, so. Oh, we're talking about Atari and about their hubris. And so, yeah, so right. So Bill Williams was, he originally did something, I forgot what the name of it was, Salmon Run for the APX system. And mm-hmm. then I got in contact with him and convinced him that his future lay brightly with Synapse rather than with Atari, and he agreed. He didn't have great experiences with that whole system. But, you know, that was sort of their tip of the hat to, we embrace programmers coming to us and we'd like to develop them. Basically, it was just like, bring us whatever's ready and, you know, and we'll turn it out. But it wasn't, you know, their coin-op part, you know, drove the other parts. And there were some very creative people in the coin-op part, you know. So it was sort of a many-headed beast, you know, with a lot of people making a lot of money and making very bad decisions because of that, all with this central theme of exclusivity, control of the system. This is the way that we're going to do it. And it was a market that wasn't ready for this kind of, you know, siloing that they were trying to do. And it's really too bad, because we, you know, Apple would really have taken a big hit had they been open. And all of the Jobs bullshit wouldn't have made that big a difference, you know. But that's another story about Jobs. Yeah.
Well, on that note.
On that note, yes. There's actually, if you're interested in other kinds of things, you know, I was really close friends with a lot of people at Bertelsmann, and with Will, you know, who founded Maxis, and then my sister then became a designer, and she was a co-designer on The Sims at Maxis and all the rest of the stuff. So the story continues, and perhaps on another day we can get into some of that interesting kind of stuff, raid on Bungling Bay, and then, you know, the sort of progression out from there to Maxis and all of the different sim products and the involvement with that stuff.
Excellent. All right.
All right, man. Hey, it's really wonderful talking to you.
I appreciate your time. Thank you so much.
All right. Bye-bye.